Welcome to Military History Inside Out, a podcast devoted to the study of how war has been waged across the centuries. In this podcast episode of Military History Inside Out, I interview history professor Dr. Ken Swope of the University of Southern Mississippi. His specialty is Chinese military history, mainly 16th and 17th century. He's written a lot on that period, and I talked to him about his upcoming book, On the Trail of the Yellow Tiger, which is about the rebellions in southwest China during the Ming-Jing transition. My pronunciation isn't very good. So there's a lot of interesting stuff here about Chinese military history and military history in general. So enjoy. Thanks. I'm speaking with Ken Swope, author of On the Trail of the Yellow Tiger. Thank you for speaking with me.
Hi, you're welcome. Great to be here.
So when did you start writing history?
When did I start writing history? I guess, well, it depends on if you consider grad school writing history, but or maybe even undergrad. It's kind of interesting that my subsequent career, which has now spanned a couple of decades almost, all emanates from like an undergraduate senior thesis that I did at the College of Worcester in Ohio on the Ming-Qing transition in China from the essentially the late 1500s through the late 1600s, 16th, 17th century stuff. And, you know, interestingly enough, the subsequent books I've written thus far have all been sort of connected to that project in some way. I've done other things that have sort of branched off. But so I guess I started writing then as a, as an undergrad, and you know, because we had to do a junior and senior thesis where I went to college. And these were significant. I mean, the senior thesis I wrote was over 200 pages. So it was a pretty long project. I mean, it was all secondary sources at that point, but, so I guess from then, so I'd say, you know, the early 90s would be the sort of date from which I began.
So I see your previous two books and this one, as you say, have that, are within that same area and focus. Have you always wanted to write a book about this particular subject that you've written on?
In this particular book, or you mean in general?
No, this particular one.
Well, in a sense, yes. What sort of happened is that the first book, because of feedback I got from that, the first monograph, the second monograph was essentially a sequel to that. And then this one came right out of the second book because I had extra material that originally I was just going to add on a little chapter at the end of the previous book I wrote. And then I realized there was so much good material out there in terms of source material and a lot of stuff that people outside of China and even in China to an extent have never really touched that I realized I had enough material for an entire additional book. And so that led me to do that. And then actually now, although I'm working on another project that's farther in the future in terms of my chronological focus, my next book after the one I'm working on now will be a sequel to this one we're talking about today. So it's like one of those Star Wars things where it keeps like having more story. I hope I don't get into prequels, you know, because those always get the bad reviews. But but the sequels just keep coming because I keep finding material. And it's interesting as a historian because you suddenly what happens is you always – you start one place and you tend to go back for origins, and then in some cases you start realizing, well, there are connections here that I didn't really understand before, but you can't understand them until you actually read the sources. And in particular, when you're reading really kind of obscure sources that not a lot of people have messed around with, then all of a sudden you start to come to realizations that, as far as I know, other people haven't had or they haven't talked about. And so it leads to the idea like, well, gosh, now I got to do a book about this next because I've seen this connection.
So tell me a little about the subject matter and focus of this particular book.
Okay, well, the title character, is the Yellow Tiger, so to speak, is a 17th century Chinese peasant rebel. And his real name is Zhang Xianzhong, but he was called at the time by contemporaries and certainly has been called later the Yellow Tiger because of his sort of personality. And he had a sort of his particular complexion of his skin, and he had scars probably from a childhood illness. And so he became this sort of legendary figure in China who was closely involved with these peasant rebellions that help overthrow the Ming Dynasty. And so my previous monograph, the last one I wrote, deals with those rebellions, and he was one of the major rebel leaders. And interestingly enough, then when the Ming actually falls, the other major peasant rebel is the guy who captures Beijing. But this guy sets up a kingdom in Sichuan province in southwest China, where he ushers in this reign of terror that supposedly, according to some of the sources, like wipes out 90% of the population in 3 years. And there's all kinds of horrific things that happen in his wake. And so this book is sort of about him, but not just about him himself, because he dies relatively early in the process. But then, even more interesting, all his lieutenants or adopted sons then become the loyalist generals defending the Ming Dynasty against the Manchu invaders. And so these guys then basically there's a fighting retreat across South and Southwest China for 20 plus years, and these guys who helped overthrow the Ming are the defenders of the Ming, and they become known as Ming loyalists, of all things. It's kind of interesting. So he himself is still somewhat of a villain, but then his sons or his adopted sons are heroes. And so the story is fascinating because you've got all this detail about what was going on militarily, socially, politically, and it's complete anarchy. I like to tell people this is Game of Thrones in China without all the gentility. I mean, there's blood and gore, and like this guy, much like the character from Game of Thrones, right? He flays people alive and stretches their skin outside his fortress. He has mountains of severed hands and heads and things piled upside outside his palace. According to his official biography, if a day went by and he didn't kill someone, that put him in a really bad mood. So he's really a fascinating character, yet he gets these people to follow him, and he's actually a pretty canny military leader. He showed appreciation for like Europe and European culture. He had a couple of Jesuit advisors, and so one of the sources I use in the book are the diaries of one of these guys who was a Jesuit priest who was there for the, you know, for 3 years witnessing all this stuff.
So tell me a little bit about the state of the Ming Dynasty at this time that made them susceptible to the downfall.
Well, essentially, well, everybody should just read the previous book, and I completely explain it. What happens is that the Ming had been, you know, successful for a couple of hundred years, but over time, like a lot of governments, about 200 plus years in, they became subject to a lot of bureaucratic gridlock, to a lot of factionalism, a lot of politics, where people would, you know, play political games and stymie the initiatives and interests of other parties for their own ends, even if it didn't really benefit the people or the government in any way. The Ming rulers, after the first couple, are not as effective in general. They tend to be raised in the palace, surrounded by sycophants and lackeys and things like this. Now, some of the late Ming rulers are a little more effective, but they still have to deal with this deeply entrenched and fractured bureaucracy. And so by the time you get into the 1620s and 30s, the system has gotten really bad. And you've got, you know, power factions of officials, like civil officials. You've got military officials who get involved with this, too. You've got eunuchs in the court who are the emperor's advisors, and they have their own secret police. And so people that are, you know, the enemy of the throne can get brought before the eunuch secret police. And most of those people, you know, never come back. They're put into jail and they die under mysterious circumstances. And as all this is taking place, you have a rising dynasty in the Northeast, the Manchus, and you have a series of state builders up there that sort of issue their challenge to the Ming. And that happens in the early 1600s. And so the Manchus they're the people who are invading, you know, as this takes place. They're the sort of enemy of the Ming by you get to this point. But the Ming are beset by factionalism within, by the Manchus coming from without, by peasant rebels within. And on top of all that, and I really talk about this actually in both the last two books, this is a period known in history as the Little Ice Age. So there's all kinds of, and we can certainly, people can identify with this, climate change taking place that lead to poor harvests, to natural disasters, to drought, locust plagues, epidemic disease, famine. And even though they had measures in place, I mean, there's no FEMA in the Ming Dynasty, and perhaps that's a good thing. But so as all these the events are taking place, you know, they're trying to recover and deal with both natural disasters, political disasters, and military challenges on multiple fronts. And in fact, a lot of these peasant rebels had been members of the government postal service. And when the government has to cut back on the postal service, they lay off a bunch of these guys and they become bandits. Huh. And then the military skills and knowledge of the terrain and everything else. Zhang Xuanzheng, he himself was actually in the army, and apparently from a young age he was kind of violent and aggressive, and so, as in many societies, he ends up in a military career. Right. But he gets into trouble early because he gets in a fight and he like strikes an officer, and they're going to execute him, but then they decide that he seems like ferocious enough that they'd like to make him a commander, but then he gets involved in another altercation and becomes a bandit. Mm-hmm. And it sort of goes from there. But then his father has an incident where his father had been a traveling sort of salesman, and he gets humiliated by some officials, and so this supposedly convinces Zhang to like kill all these officials later, because his father had been humiliated by them when he was a kid, and so he has this sort of revenge factor in mind. But I mean, it's really interesting because the Ming sort of it's got its own dynamic, but it's also tied into these global patterns, and people have written about the so-called global crisis of the 17th century, whereby you've got military uprisings and revolutions all across Eurasia. You know, in the Ottoman Empire and in Western Europe and in China and Russia and Japan, and all these places are sort of affected at the same time.
So Zhang, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that properly, but so it sounds like he had something of a national outlook, at least, and he seemed to know more about his world beyond, say, the simple village, you know, he grew up in.
Yeah, it's one of the fascinating things about these Ming peasant rebels. For one, a lot of them were literate, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. Now, Ming China, we don't have exact figures, but the generally accepted figure is that maybe almost 50% of men had some degree of functional literacy, which is really, I mean, that's the highest in the world at the time, as far as we know, and talk about 17th century. But it is amazing when you read these accounts that these peasants seem to have been literate, have some sense of, you know, Chinese history and tradition. How much of that is sort of created by historians is unclear. But definitely they have a sort of national and even supranational focus. And I think part of that is because the Ming itself was a pretty dynamic society at this time. There's a lot of foreign trade going on. The Ming economy is propelled by silver from the Americas. And these peasants in particular, they travel all over because they're rebels. So they're constantly running from government forces. So you get to see a lot of the empire when you're on the run. And these guys, and that's fact, the Ming sources call them the wandering bandits. And that's why they're so hard to defeat, because they don't have central bases. They move from place to place. And they develop a pretty wide worldview because they're associating with all kinds of officials and military guys. And like in his case, a couple of Jesuits. So there are some connections to the outside world. So, and although Zhang himself, as far as I know, he never goes to Beijing. Now, the other guy does, but I don't think Zhang ever gets to Beijing.
So how it sounds like it's a sort of environment where the economy is actually doing pretty well, sounds like it, you know, and if these guys are moving around, you know, how do they sustain themselves, and is the populace not fighting back against them? You know, it seems like they kind of have some freedom of movement.
Well, that's part of the problem, of course. Remember, is that we're talking about a massive pre-modern empire. So while the travel routes and the trade routes and the sort of postal routes and things were relatively advanced for the time, still the communication infrastructure is not what it is in a modern state. You've got And the area that they tend to operate in is forested and mountainous, so you can disappear pretty easily. A lot of the ordinary peasants work with them. They're either part of their armies. They come and go. They join with them. They work as spies with them. Because what had happened is, even though there was a general level of prosperity, the Ming had been involved in a lot of wars. There's a massive war to defend Korea from the Japanese in the 1590s. They're fighting the Manchus. And so they had been raising taxes to kind of pay for these conflicts, particularly the Manchu conflict. And so part of the problem is that the tax burden is not distributed evenly. And a lot of the wealthy people find all kinds of tax holes and dodges, whereas so all the tax burden, hey, surprise, surprise, falls on the poor people. Yeah. And so some of them, once things get really bad and their taxes are too high, harvests are bad, they join the rebels. And so then the state is constantly forced with this dilemma. Like, even when they beat the rebels in battle, do you kill them all? Or, knowing that a lot of them have just sort of been impressed and the servers are gone out of desperation, do you just arrest and kill ringleaders and then let the other ones go? Mm-hmm. And because they're your subjects, the government can't just kill all its people. Even Chen Zhong realizes that at one point. Like, mm-hmm. you can't just kill everyone because then no one pays taxes or does anything for you. Yeah. And so from the government perspective, these guys are moving from place to place, and it does suggest that there's still, even if the government's having trouble getting taxes in, there must be some level of productivity mm-hmm. and resources, because these guys can sustain armies of tens of thousands in the field, and the Ming army itself is hundreds of thousands, the national army, maybe over a million even at this point. Mm-hmm. And so there's still money to be had. It's just a matter of where you get it from. And so the emperor, is one of the things they do is they resort to sending out eunuchs to be tax collectors, mm-hmm. because the eunuchs have direct connection to the ruler and not to any other powerful families.
Right.
Of course, the other officials hate this. And so in history, the historical records, the official records, always say that the problem was that the eunuchs were out oppressing the people and the officials were serving the people. But that's not really true. Mm-hmm. The officials were hiding their money, and the only way the emperors could get it was to use the eunuchs as thugs to sort of shake them down. Mm-hmm. And so that's where when you actually get into the history and you look at some of these alternative records, you see that a lot of the sort of received wisdom about the eunuchs being evil and the officials being good is really self-serving. I mean, there were good and bad officials, there were good and bad eunuchs. Mm-hmm. And so the state actually, once the Manchus take over, they kind of get rid of some of the corruption and sort of revamp the system a little bit, but they basically keep the Ming political system intact, and it functions pretty effectively for another 200 years, almost 150 years, whatever, mm-hmm. after the Qing conquest. So clearly the system, could function if it was, properly run.
So, and you may have touched on this already, but what would you say is the main theme you're exploring in this book?
Actually, the main theme is looking at the effects of war on local society and ideas of trauma, social upheaval, dislocation, movement, from place to place, and how war intersects with society at the local level. Because the part of China that I emphasize in this book is Southwest China, which was, in this period especially, and even is to some degree today, less developed than the kind of major areas in the East and the Southeast, more of a frontier area. But this is where the longest sustained fighting happens during the Ming-Qing transition. Mm. You have uprisings, revolts among minority peoples in the early 1600s, and then you have a series of wars that go into the late 1600s. So for essentially a century, these provinces in the Southwest are in some form of military conflict. And so it leads to tremendous demographic changes. A lot of people move out of the area, other people move in. Societies are sort of disrupted because there are all these minority groups and tribes that live in this area of China. And so they get sucked up into these events as well.
So this part of Southwest China at the time, what part of modern China does that correspond to?
Essentially, it's Sichuan, Guangxi, Yunnan, and Guizhou provinces. So these provinces, they're sort of considered southwest of China proper, but I guess they'd be kind of, they're north of Burma and Vietnam and Sichuan borders. Sichuan and Yunnan both border on Tibet as well.
Okay.
So when you get into western Sichuan, that's a lot of Tibetan culture there.
Okay. So what are the resources you use to do your research?
That is actually the breadth and variety of sources is what really convinced me to do this particular topic, because the Ming-Qing dynastic transition, of all the imperial dynastic shifts, and obviously there are many, we have the most detailed records from this one. And there are a variety of reasons for that. Obviously, it was the most recent traditional shift, not counting the one in the 20th century when the Republic takes over. So it's the most recent. You had large literacy levels, as I mentioned earlier. So a lot of people can read and write. A lot of people are writing stuff down. The transition lasts, often, depending on how you want to date it, for like 40 years. So you've got a variety of different types of sources. You've got memoirs. You've got diaries. You've got battlefield reports from both the Ming and the Qing commanders. You've got imperial proclamations from the Ming loyalist emperors and the Qing emperors. You have a few foreign accounts. You have other sort of what they call wild or unofficial histories written by people either at the time or in the decades or centuries following, you know, family chronicles. You have what the Chinese call gazetteers, which are local histories of counties or cities or prefectures, things like that. So you have a tremendous variety of these kind of sources that you can look at. So you really get a great picture of things. I mean, in some of them, you have folk tales, short stories, ghost stories. I mean, all kinds of things about this period that really make it rich to give you a sense of what was going on at the time. And some of these chronicles, I mean, the guy who was one of the Qing commanders, who a former Ming general who defects to the Qing and was responsible for the pacification mostly of Sichuan, his records is 24 volumes of, you know, letters and correspondence and things. And it's just amazing how detailed it is. And so there's just a lot of really rich material for this era.
So where is most of that housed, or is it just spread out everywhere currently?
Well, luckily, for various reasons, a lot of the materials were gathered and compiled in big compilations during the Qing dynasty and in various imperial projects in the Qing period, because they wanted to chronicle the conquest, particularly stuff that was favorable to them. Other things were gathered in compilations in the 19th and 20th centuries in mainland China and Taiwan, so a good portion of the material has been published in, you know, one form or another. More recently in China, various provincial and regional publishing houses have gathered collections of materials on peasant rebellions in general. A lot of stuff was done on peasant rebellions in the early communist era because they wanted to find peasant heroes from the past to put their own revolution in context. So even though some of the intros and stuff of these materials were politicized, you know, they always start and end with a quotation from Chairman Mao, but the actual material is great because it's the primary sources of peasant rebellion from different perspectives, you know, folk tales, government campaigns, letters, you know, dispatches, that sort of thing. So you've got those. You've got the official, you know, dynastic history of the Ming dynasty, the dynastic history of the Qing dynasty, the veritable records of these different reigns. As I mentioned, memoirs and diaries, and these are transmitted by families, and then some of them are put into compilations. And then, there are a few, like, unique sources that are held in libraries. Most of them are in China. So I had to go to the National Library of China for a couple of things that are unique manuscripts that are in, like, their rare book collection because there's only one copy or two copies in the world. Like, in one case, there was a copy in Tokyo and a copy in Beijing. And then, so that's where I got most of that rare stuff. There are a few things out in provincial libraries, but the rarest and most unique items I got were in different branches of the National Library of China.
Were there any artifacts or objects that you came across that informed your this writing?
Yeah, actually there were, and so, like, the first time I went to China in two different summers to kind of complete research. So the first time I went was mostly in the archives, and then I did some field work out in Sichuan, and Chongqing, and in and up in Zhangxianzhong's base in Chengdu, and I eventually found Zhangxianzhong's grave, which is in a tiny little village in the middle of nowhere out in Sichuan province. And it was quite difficult to find. I mean, because we went to this town and we started asking people, like, this cab driver said, well, I think I kind of know where it is. And it's behind this temple up on a mountain outside of town. And so we, like, checked this little guidebook in our hotel that we were staying in, my wife and I. And then we called the cabbie up. And so we go up this thing and we're asking directions from people to people. And finally, this local police security officer comes by. And because we were at this temple and the monks went and got him. And he comes by and he goes, oh, yeah, I know where it is. He goes, I'll take you there. So he unlocks his gate and we walk up this winding mountain path. And there it is. There's this gravestone at the top of this hill. And there's some incense sticks, like somebody had done some sort of sacrifice to him. And then there's, like, a couple of random, like, plastic bottles of water there. Like, they're just thrown around garbage. You know, they had sacrificed and then threw their garbage there. So we saw that. So that was one artifact, like one place we found. I found a place where later in the book, a couple of Ming loyalist generals are executed by a Manchu commander, and that was by chance. I was in the city of Guilin and traveling to different historical sites there, because a lot of action in the book happens there. And I found this public park, and we walk through this gate, and all of a sudden, we find these sort of, what do you call them, steles, that have the pictures of these two famous martyrs. One of them, incidentally, was a Catholic convert, and they were executed here by the Manchu military commander, who had been a Ming commander. And so I found the cave where they had been executed, and they've got little plaques to them with their story there. And then when we went to southwest China, the city of Kunming, where the Ming general Wu Sangui eventually kills the last Ming emperor, we found the place where the emperor had been executed. Mm-hmm. There's a little stone there. And a little marker there. And then there was another, and then at a park somewhere else in town, after the guy executed him, he later felt bad. So he built a little shrine to the emperor at this other park. And so we went there. And so that was pretty interesting. And then more recently, although I haven't seen these themselves, there was a big naval battle fought between Zhang Shanzhong's forces and Ming loyalist forces in 1647. And just in the last year and a half, they've discovered thousands of artifacts from this battle. And a river, and they're dredging them up. So they put dams up, and they dredged like 30,000 artifacts out. Wow. Weapons, silver, like silver coins, little ingots, tools, jewelry, all kinds of stuff that he tried to escape with when he was fleeing, and his ships got sunk. Oh. And so for a while, they weren't sure if this was a real story, but now they've definitively dated and identified a lot of these items. And so I just did a paper on this discovery last fall in Hong Kong, at a maritime archaeology conference. And so it's very timely that the book will be coming out this summer, because now there's a lot of interest in this in China. Like the Chinese version of Facebook and Google and stuff, there's all these stories you can find about the sunken treasure of Zhang Shanzhong. And so it's pretty interesting.
What part of China did that sink in, or did it occur?
It was in Sichuan. It was in Sichuan province. So it was south of the city of Chengdu, which is the capital of Sichuan, towards Chongqing, on the way to Chongqing.
What river is that?
I think it was the Jin River. I think it was the Jin River.
So do
I have to check. Two rivers that go around Chengdu, and I think it was the Jin that this one was in.
Okay. So I guess, is there an older version of written and... written Chinese from this period that you've learned or you know? Or
the original documents are written in what they call Wenyan or classical Chinese, and so the Chinese characters are called traditional characters, right? And so the communists created a simplified form of Chinese characters in the 1950s, and that's what they teach in China now. But in Taiwan and Hong Kong, they still use the traditional characters. But the writing style is quite a bit different from modern Chinese. There are a lot of classical references to history and historical figures. And there's no punctuation in classical Chinese. So it can be very difficult to figure out when sentences begin and end. Sometimes they use alternate forms of characters or shortened forms, abbreviated forms for official titles and things like that. And so it can be challenging, to read stuff. Usually it takes a while to get used to documents from a certain era. And then once you read a lot of them, you get more comfortable with it.
Right.
But it's definitely specialized. And this is compounded by the fact that some of these things are handwritten manuscripts. So it's not printed, it's handwritten, which means that it can be even more difficult to read.
Right.
And even just handwriting is usually pretty neat. In the case of one of the documents I read at the National Library was in such bad shape, and it was the only copy in the world, that they wouldn't let me touch it. I had to sit there all day in the library with a librarian, and she wore gloves. Right. And she would turn page by page as I read, and then I could transcribe, either copy it or just transcribe it in pencil. In my own notebook, because they wouldn't let me take digital photos. And then I would just say, like, Sean, which means turn the page, like, all day. And she would sit there for 8 hours with me all day, because, I would go there when they opened and leave when they closed, because they would only give me a few days to read them, because these documents are so precious. Right. That they're like, okay, you get, 2 days per document or 2 days per source.
Right.
And the one case, the stuff was really long, and so my wife argued with them. She's Chinese. She argued with them to give me an extra 2 days because the source was so long. And she's like, he's a foreigner. He can't read Chinese as fast as us. There's no way he can read all this in 2 days. I've got to give him more time. And so finally they give me an extra 2 days. I still didn't really get through all of it, but I got through more of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a really long one. The other sources were short enough that in 2 days I could read them, but it was pretty interesting just to see that stuff.
So what part of the research for this particular book was most enjoyable?
It's probably a combination of doing that stuff in the National Library and just knowing that literally a handful of people in the entire world have ever read this stuff and looked at it. And so just finding things and seeing like, wow, you know, like in 400 years, how many people have ever had the chance to look at this?
Right.
I mean, that was pretty cool. And then actually to go to a few of the battlefield sites and see, you know, just kind of see the lay of the land and stuff. I mean, there's one famous pass that they go through to take the city of Chongqing. And it's funny because all these cities, like back in the Ming, they were much smaller. So you go there now and this strategic pass is in the middle of the city and it's in like some city park. Mm-hmm. And so you go there and you're like, well, but then you get a view and you're up on this mountain and you can see the entire city of Chongqing around you. Mm-hmm. And you're like, now I see why this was so strategically important, because at the time, if the city's down below on the river, this is definitely the way you want to go in.
Right.
But now it's just like, yeah, whatever, you know, you just, there's a subway stop, you get off there, mm-hmm. and then you walk out to this site. But, you know, back then when it was much smaller, it's a different location. But just to see some of these, you know, their weapons and things and places where these people actually lived is pretty interesting. I mean, as a military historian, it's always fun to get out into the field a little bit and see like where these battles happened. And unfortunately, to the present at least, unlike here, for example, there's not a lot of preservation of battlefields in China or things like that. Historical tourism is just kind of getting started. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's not like going to Gettysburg or one of those places where you would see that. I mean, you go to a few places and they might talk about a battle. There's like one little plaque or something.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not like a big park kind of infrastructure for that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to do more kind of historic tourism, but it's not nearly as developed as it is here.
Right. What did you find that was most surprising in your research?
I would say probably the kind of frank discussion of, you know, sort of problems and issues that were going on at the time. I mean, some people are very critical of even their own side and sort of sensitive to the plight of ordinary people. And, you know, it's very humanizing when they talk about, you know, the piteous cries of children and lamentations of women and these sorts of things and how they, you know, the effects of being away from home and not being able to eat traditional food or whatever. And then sort of these kind of stories, as well as the kind of, what also was really, I don't know if it's surprising, but really fascinating, is there's a lot of sort of, they're not really urban legends because this is rural area, but rural like legends and folklore that get brought in. So stories of ghosts and humans that turn into vampires and cannibalism. Mm-hmm. And some of that stuff is really interesting because it's just sort of kind of dropping in and it's like, oh yeah, by the way, then Zhang Xianzhong started seeing ghosts and there were headless ghosts wandering around his palace.
Uh-huh.
And there were disembodied hands that took food out of his mouth. And then I started finding these stories from other periods. And so I came up with this notion that in China, there's a recurrent rhetoric of catastrophe. Like certain things happen and they use a specific kind of vocabulary to talk about these things.
Hmm.
And that was kind of interesting to see that, like, this is specific to this era, but when you go to the end of the Manchu dynasty, you find some of the same types of stories and things being brought up again. And sort of accounts of what happens. What also is interesting is the repeated emphasis on disorder. Like what chaos brings and why you need government.
Mm-hmm.
You need a strong government to prevent chaos. Because when chaos occurs, you have, you know, the spirit world is out of hand. You have tiger attacks. You have wolf attacks.
Mm-hmm.
You have people reverting to cannibalism. You have all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you really need in the end is a strong centralized government to kind of, you know, run things. Whether that's Ming or Qing depends on your perspective. But certainly they both lament and blame the other side.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about these folk tales and the ghosts and stuff. Are these aren't stories told sort of in a way that they curse the other side and are gleeful that they're suffering? Is it more just like they notice or they just kind of express their observation that this must be going on?
Yeah, and it seems to be tied to the idea of disorder and chaos in the world in general. And so when the human realm is disordered, so is the spirit realm and the natural world. And so animals that normally would not, you know, be in areas that humans are dwelling, like tigers. Like, there's a lot of emphasis on tiger attacks and statistics on how many people are getting eaten by tigers. But when the Manchus finally restore order, all of a sudden those accounts of tiger attacks vastly diminish.
Huh.
And it's interesting because there's clearly they're sort of saying that once order happens, and the same thing with the ghosts and stuff. Like, there are a lot of ghost stories from the Ming Qing transition. Then they tend to tail off. But then when you get to the mid-19th century of these major rebellions again, a couple hundred years later, all of a sudden there are all these ghost stories again. Hmm. And stories about phantom armies and headless ghosts and these sorts of things. And so it's generally more about order and disorder than blaming one side or the other, although certainly, you know, there are, you know, incidents that are perpetrated by the Manchus or by the Ming that lead to these sort of ghostly developments. And those stories are really interesting about people going feral and living in trees. Like, people, there are stories about people that become like they grow fur and they get really light steps like deer so that they can float into the trees and escape. People come to see them. You know, so they're it's really interesting. And it also is interesting is that this part of China, or part of this area that's covered by the book, is the area nowadays where people, where there are supposedly reports of the Yeren, which is like the Chinese Bigfoot, the Wild Man. And so it's in the same area of China that some of these stories originate. So they could actually be referring to, if there is a Yeren, right, some type of ape or animal that people are seeing that they're identifying with, like, debased humans.
Mm-hmm. So did either side, either the peasant army or the government forces, did they engage much in reading omens or any kind of superstitious acts to protect themselves?
Oh yeah, they not only read them, they manufactured them. And so at times, like, the peasants will create their own omens to inspire each other to fight and things like this. Certainly the peasant rebels at the end of the Ming do a lot of this. The government does some of this. In fact, there's a, before the city of, it's the city of Chengdu, before Chengdu falls, one of the sources records that all the turtles in one of these lakes in the city, like, left spontaneously. And so there's some legend that says if the turtles leave spontaneously, the city's about to fall. And so that's one of the stories about the fall of Chengdu, is that all the turtles ran away. And so you see some of these in their accounts, like the peasant rebels, to scare, like, when they were ready to attack a town, sometimes they'd get a bunch of children to go around in circles and cry and make noise outside, because children spontaneously crying at night is a sign of doom to come. Or they put bloody handprints on the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's a sign of, like, ghosts are coming or something. And so, yeah, you definitely see some of that. But then at other times, you see references to the superstitious peasants will believe this, so we must make sure that they understand that, you know, this is not happening. And so you see this from the, you know, but the government uses omens, but they also try to discourage people from listening to them. And so it's curious, because you can clearly see that a lot of people kind of believe in it, but there's also skepticism involved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's great about reading the sources, because they are sometimes, they're balanced. They're not just totally credulous.
I guess the Jesuits must have had quite a time trying to deal with all that popular belief.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's interesting, because when you read their accounts, especially the ones they send back to Rome, they're always trying to put a positive spin on what's happening in the form of conversion. So, yeah, this guy's a bloodthirsty, maniacal dictator, but he expressed an interest in building a Catholic church later. So, you know, we should keep this in mind. And at times they'll say, like, positive things, even about Zhang Xianzhong. But then they also throw in their comments about Buddhism and polytheism and all these other sorts of things that they don't like. Hmm. But they are definitely interested in, you know, high culture and the sort of erudition of the Confucian scholars.
Was Taoism much of a, I don't know my Chinese religion that well, but was Taoism active in this period, or influential.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, Zhang Xianzong himself was heavily into sort of Taoist religious beliefs. And so Taoism is both a philosophy and a religion. So a lot of the Chinese folk gods are sort of, they're connected to the Taoist pantheon. Some of them are Buddhist. Some of them are both. Mm. And so there's no, you know, most ordinary people would not self-identify as any one or the other. They just kind of take it all in. Mm-hmm. And so Taoism, Confucianism, Buddhism, you know, put it all together. That's Chinese religion. And it's like even Chinese religious experts, which I am not, like they admit that they're confounded because there is no one orthodoxy. I remember a couple of years ago, there was some discussion on like one of these HNET server lists about the proper way to set up a shrine in your house. Mm-hmm. And like one post got 17 or whatever, 20 different responses from specialists in Buddhism or whatever. So everybody had a different response on what the proper way to set up a house shrine is. So it all depends on your perspective.
So what was the most difficult part of your research in that something that was really difficult to answer or maybe is still a mystery to you?
Well, the biggest challenge, I guess, was at times figuring out, you know, motivations for people and just keeping all the characters and individuals straight in terms of how things happen and how they sort of fit together, because there are, you know, literally hundreds of documents, and at times you've got dozens of kind of major players. And so at times it's sort of difficult to figure out precisely why somebody like joined with somebody else, or what a particular motivation was, or you know, why somebody decided to do A rather than B, because you might get, they might not even mention it, or you might get 3 or 4, 5 different explanations depending on which source you read. So trying to correlate all these different threads and put them together and figure out exactly what's going on and how it kind of fits into some coherent whole, it was probably the biggest challenge. I mean, because, you know, a lot of people have written about the Ming-Qing transition before, so the general sort of narrative events is fairly well established. But just, you know, who did what, why, is sometimes a little bit confusing. Like, why did Zhang Xianzong's, why did his adopted sons decide to become Ming loyalists? Mm-hmm. And it's still, I mean, I have my suppositions, but some of them seem completely self-interested, but one of them in particular seems like he really was legitimate. Mm-hmm. But we don't necessarily know why, except what his sort of defenders tell you, mm-hmm. as his sort of modern Chinese supporters tell you.
So was there anything you discovered that emotionally moved you? And I don't just mean sadness, in maybe something very funny or amusing or just, you know, emotionally powerful.
Yeah, well, I think what for me is really interesting is how, you know, some of these figures, and I do think, I mean, it'd be a fantastic sort of like, and the Chinese have written novels and there are Chinese movies and stuff, but it would really be a very moving kind of picture or mini series or something, in the sense of how some of these people really do become kind of devoted to a national or regional cause, like, and really, even though it's pretty obvious that they're in a bad situation, they keep fighting, you know, to the end. And so that General Li Dinghua, when everything is kind of falling apart, he's still, to the very end, is trying to save the last Ming emperor from, the guy gets imprisoned by the king of Burma, and he's trying to save him, and he's fighting elephants, and in the end, like, the emperor is captured and executed, and supposedly the day Li gets the letter that the emperor has been executed, he becomes sick himself and dies a couple of months later, and then he tells his son and his nephew, you know, the son of one of his best friends, he's like, whatever you do, never surrender to the Manchus. You know, this is what he says on his deathbed. And of course they both do. They both get sinecures as princes and surrender to the Manchus like a few weeks later. But he's still revered as a great hero. And so it's just, and some of these fun stories, I mean, these people who are like, no, like it's they're going to their doom and they continue to fight. There's some interesting stuff. And there are like some, you know, some women warriors who are very prominent in the story, and their husbands die, and then they become warriors themselves. And so some really fascinating stuff.
Mm-hmm. So what do you hope the book will do for this specific field of, you know, Chinese military history or military history for this period?
Well, what I'm hoping to do is certainly connect into this literature on, the 17th century crisis and the kind of, what was going on globally, but also provide a sense of, how warfare was, sort of experienced in the 17th century, not just in China, but how you can extrapolate out and get some sense of these events, because these events and the figures around them were repeatedly then used, the major figures were repeatedly used throughout Chinese history since then, up to the present. I mean, there are movies, books, comics, all these things that talk about these different characters as kind of moral examples, as political exemplars, as, loyalists or traitor, that sort of thing. And so there's a lot of sort of resonance in modern Chinese history, 19th, 20th century, 21st century, even Chinese history. So I think from the China perspective, it'll be interesting maybe for people to see, get more of the details of these people and then how their memories or sacrifices were used by different groups later for specific political or other ends, and then in a global sense to get a sense of, hey, and we're talking about 17th century warfare, China, there are far more sources probably in China than anywhere else in the world. And I was just rereading John Keegan recently, his talk of discussion of the Battle of Waterloo, mm-hmm. and how that's so important because you have so many more sources for that than you have for previous European battles. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, like, well, that's even what they have for Waterloo probably is about equivalent, if not equivalent, to what you have in the Ming. And so I think if people really want to get a sense of the lived, as much as you can, with the experience of war mm-hmm. and how it affects, different segments of society, men, women, children, minorities, conquerors, the conquered, mm-hmm. You can get that from this story.
Hmm. Interesting. So can you speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book published and how you overcame them?
I can't because there were none.
Okay, that's good.
It actually was really smooth. What happened was, and I should tell this for people out there, right? It's good to know somebody. And so my previous book had just gone into production, and I had an idea. I had an idea for this book, and I wrote a grant proposal for a grant to be a one-year visitor somewhere. And I didn't get the grant, but by the time I'd written the proposal, I realized I had a book proposal. And so my friend David Graff is a series editor at Nebraska Press. Mm-hmm. It's called Studies in War, Society, and Military.
Right.
So I approached him, and I said, hey, do you think these guys might be interested in this book? And he said, sure, probably. And so I sent it off to them. And within 3 or 4 months, I got a positive response, and they sent me a contract. Uh-huh. And so they were like, "Yeah, we like this," because the first book had done really well. The second book was in production, and so they knew, I had a track record. Hmm. And that's what I'd say to new authors in general: get your stuff out there, get a decent press the first time around, but then establish the sense of that you're going to get stuff done, and then it becomes easier to get the publications out. Because once people know who you are, do the conference circuit, do some articles, get your name out there, and say yes to as much as you can mm-hmm. early on in your career, and that will help. Because then a lot of people know you and they know your work, mm-hmm. and so when they send it out, people are like, "Oh yeah, I read his first book and I really liked it," mm-hmm. and that kind of thing helps. I mean, I think sometimes young, especially people right out of PhD, are so intimidated that they want to spend like 10 years revising their dissertation to make it a book and make it perfect. Mm-hmm. And I would say no, just find the right fit and get it out there. And then, because it's never going to be as good as you want it, no matter what you do.
Right. So you already mentioned your next writing project. Can you briefly just touch on how you're going to approach it as far as researching?
Yeah. The new one is interesting because, again, it's one of these things that I had not, I planned on doing it for a long time, but I just was doing other stuff. And so the new project is actually the one that's not the sequel to this. The one I'm working on right now is a biography of General Zhou. Mm-hmm. So the guy that the chicken dish is named after, General Zhou's chicken,
right?
The real guy, and so people like, and I was literally inspired to write that because every time I tell people I study Chinese history, so what about that General Cao guy? And I'm like, damn it, I'm just going to write a book about him and just tell people, read my damn book. And so that's, I'm writing the true story of General Zhou, but he was a 19th century general. Mm-hmm. And so he gets involved in suppressing all the major 19th century rebellions in China, the Taiping Rebellion, the Nian Rebellion, He builds China's first naval shipyard in the city of Fuzhou in southeast China. Hmm. He builds a woolen factory in the northwest. And then he crushes a bunch of massive Muslim rebellions in north China and comes up with a very sophisticated counterinsurgency doctrine for dealing with Muslim uprisings. And so now all these military and counterinsurgency guys are interested in this book because they want to see, because he talks about winning hearts and minds and different kinds of Muslims. There are the Muslims that you can work with, the ones that you just kill. And he comes up with this very like elaborate doctrine. So I'm actually doing a book on him now. And the sort of first step is doing a background reading and biographies and stuff. And then I've got his collected works, which are 16 volumes, about 500 pages each of classical Chinese. And it's like letters and, you know, and military reports and all that. And then there are a bunch of campaign histories, sort of what the Qing dynasty did against these different rebels. And so I'm going to be going through those as well. And so, and virtually all of this stuff has been published in different versions. So I'll probably go to China because they've apparently tried to turn his like where he lived in his hometown into a bit of a tourist site because he's really famous in China. Yeah. Not for the chicken dish because that's an American dish. Yeah. Nobody knows about this dish in China. And interestingly enough, his favorite dish was dog. But you know, I don't think we're going to get a lot of General Zhuo's dog here. But I'm going to go to the village, you know, probably next year, and just check it out and see what they've done as far as a historical site. But that's the project I'm into now.
Okay, so where can people find your works?
Definitely Amazon. That's probably the best place. You know, the different publishers also sell them. You know, Nebraska Press has this book that we're talking about today. That's the University of Nebraska Press. The first one was Oklahoma. Then Rutledge. I publish a lot of stuff for Rutledge. And so, you know, Rutledge Press, they have that. They have stuff on their website as well. Major academic conferences, Society for Military History, Association for Asian Studies. Sadly, I've yet to see a trade bookstore in the United States with these, but I have seen them in England. British bookstores in London carry my books. So, be watching in London. Yeah. Go to Charing Cross Road, and there are a couple of big bookstores that have my books, and the British Museum sells them, because I did a conference there a few years ago, and they had copies of my books for sale at the British Museum, of all places. So you can find them there.
Nice. So, any final thoughts?
My main thing would be, you know, people should really, you know, explore Chinese military history. There's a lot of unexplored stuff out there. There are a lot of interesting things that really correspond to what's going on elsewhere militarily. I think Europeanists tend to have, you know, blinders sometimes and think that, you know, certain developments are unique to Europe or only apply to them in terms of technology, organization, experience, etc. But in fact, there's plenty of stuff going on in China that also has resonance for other parts of the world. And along those lines, you know, China was heavily involved in military affairs. You know, some people say, oh, it's Confucian culture, it was pacifist. That is a total myth.
All right. Thank you, then. Thank you for listening. More information can be found at warscholar.org.